behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben, and we're here with Noel, the Madman Brown.
Mm-hmm. Madman is a good, Madman is a variation, very close, but acceptable for a nickname for Noel, yeah.
Yeah, for now. And it's only, we're not calling him the Madman Brown because of any lingering mental issues or anything. No. He's right as rain. It's just we like to have a little bit of a fun time with the nicknames and the title of the show. What are we talking about today, Scott?
Oh, this is pretty exciting. This is the Mad Max Furry Road. What, not Furry Road?
No, it's Fury Road.
Oh, my God. I'm going to have to redo all of my research for today then. I was doing Mad Max Furry,
Furry Road.
Road. Yeah, and I found some really weird stuff online while I was looking for this, and I was thinking, this can't be right.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say that that is not also a film, because I don't know.
We're a car show, and yet
right.
This was like all about conventions with people dressed up like raccoons
oh,
and crazy things.
Yeah.
And bizarre stuff was going on there. I mean,
yeah.
I read some really deep stuff. I could go on with my notes here, or we could regroup and...
Well, you're already a car aficionado, and you know this stuff pretty well. What if we just go with Fury Road for this podcast?
The movie,
the film, yeah, the movie.
Well, that's completely different, and I guess we can talk about that today. How about that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. Let's do that then. So today we're going to talk about the cars of Mad Max Fury Road, and I guess we can describe some of the stuff that happened in previous Mad Max films, because it's a whole franchise at this point.
Right.
We'll keep it brief on that, because there's some fantastic cars that are in this Fury Road movie that is recent, very recent.
Yeah.
Within the last month, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. May 15th, I think.
Yeah, kind of depends on when this podcast comes out, I guess, but yeah,
sure.
Pretty recent. I'll have to admit right up front, I haven't seen it yet. I was out of town for a long time just after it was released, and I haven't been able to get to it yet, but I do plan to. You have seen it, right?
Oh, yes.
And what do you think? I mean, just a general overall, how does it stack up?
Well, on a 1 to 10, I would give this a 14, a solid 14.
Wow.
It is great, man. No spoilers, but the bulk of the movie is one long car chase through the desert with these strange, homemade, cobbled together Frankenstein monster kind of cars. And as we're going to find in today's episode, these are not as Hollywood as a lot of other cars. We've talked about it before wherein, you know, you'll have something like not a Batmobile, but for the sake of argument, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And really, all it has inside of it is a little V6 to just keep it moving so mm-hmm. it can drive on and off set.
Sure.
And it can't actually do stunts. These things are the real deal, Scott. And I didn't believe it when I was first watching the film. And I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it. But what we are going to talk about today are going to be the cars of Mad Max, because they're as much, each one is as much a character as, you know, Mad Max or the other ones. And that's kind of always been the case, right, with going back to the very first one.
Oh, very much so. And you know what? The difference between this film and the previous films is that this one is really, like you said, it's just a chase. It's like a one long chase scene from the very beginning to the very end,
mm-hmm.
all the way across the desert, like a caravan trying to make its way and other people trying to disrupt that caravan.
Right.
We'll get to that one at the end of this this list here, but I can give you just like some quick summaries or some synopsis, I guess,
mm-hmm.
of the Mad Max films, if you'd like, just so
yeah.
you understand where we're coming from. And if you haven't seen, you know, the entire Mad Max series, I guess it's worthwhile to check into it. I have seen these, you know, in the past, like when I was much, much younger.
Yeah.
I think the last one I saw, of course, was Beyond Thunderdome back in 1985. Now, that's a long time ago. You know, is that 30 years now?
Come on, man. Don't say that.
Is that 30 years?
It is 30 years.
30
Scott.
Years ago. All right. So I was watching some previews, some trailers, things
mm-hmm.
like that from 1985 on YouTube currently, like today or even, you know, yesterday, the week before, whatever. And, I gotta say, some of the copies that I've seen, you know, don't really stand up because they're probably VHS copies that were then converted to DVD,
oh,
which were
yeah.
then converted to some electronic form that they could put online. And they don't look quite as great as they did, or as I remember them, on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
But going all the way back to 1979, We started with the Mad Max film, I guess, the very first film. It's an Australian film. And all right, I guess this is the way IMDb describes it. Maybe that's the way we'll do it because we'll keep it concise.
Sure.
It says, in a self-destructing world, a vengeful Australian policeman sets out to stop a violent motorcycle gang. So really, this is about the breakdown of society. I mean, it's a murderous, vengeful society that this guy is in. His name is Max.
Right.
And he just becomes a cold-hearted, killer, I guess.
Yeah, well, he is, at this time, he's one of the last sort of lawmen around because the story is about society breaking down and the rule of law sort of deteriorating. But he is what's called a main force patrol officer. So they're kind of like the last of the police.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everything goes horribly wrong for him.
Of course. And he kind of throughout this one, he loses his humanity.
Exactly.
He becomes less and less human. Mm-hmm. So, on to 1981 when they came out with Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. And I'll just read this again.
Yeah.
In the post-apocalyptic Australian wasteland, a cynical drifter agrees to help a small gasoline-rich community escape a band of bandits. Now, that's important, the gasoline-rich part, because they had the fuel that the bandits needed in order to make their machines still run and operate.
Mm-hmm.
That became their valuable commodity that they had that these bandits were after. And, it, of course, made for good action scenes. You know, they're trying to steal their most valuable commodity.
Right. And at this point in the universe, I guess, of Mad Max, the social situation is further deteriorating and it's getting to the point where very few places are capable of creating fuel, you know?
Sure.
So we see the desperation, uncertainty that was already there in the first Mad Max just get worse. Things keep getting worse, right?
Yeah. So it's this band of settlers, I guess, is the way you can describe them.
Sure.
I suppose.
Yeah.
And later in this film, towards the end, Max is kind of shown to like rediscover his humanity a bit. He's maybe not as hardened as he was in the past, you know, like in the other films. And I guess in the very beginning of Mad Max Part 2, they also give you a little backstory about what happened in Part 1, which is nice. All right.
Yeah.
So then, 1985, just 4 years later, they came out with Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And this is where a former Australian policeman, okay, that's Max again, is rescued by a tribe of children when he's banished from the desert town and sent into the desert to die by the desert's evil, well, that's a lot of desert, by the desert's town, the desert town's evil queen. So this evil queen, and what was her name again? Is it Furiosa? Is that her name? Or am I thinking of the current one? Maybe?
That's the current one.
That's the current one.
Auntie Entity.
Ah, that's it. Okay.
Auntie Entity.
Auntie Entity. Okay. This is interesting. So it's an evil town, that was ruled by Tina Turner. Now that's strange.
Yeah.
I mean, to think about it now when you look back at, you know, Tina Turner's
Entity
career.
Is played by Tina Turner.
Yeah, weird, huh? All right. And Max is now a gladiator.
Mm-hmm. In the Thunderdome.
This is so straight. In the Thunderdome. So he's a gladiator in the Thunderdome.
Two men enter.
And then
one man leaves.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, the chant. And then he is he's banished from this I guess what do they call it, the Citadel, is it? Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Yeah.
Where he was later recovered by these desert orphans. And I don't know, geez, what more could you ask for in a film, really?
Right? Right. Nothing. I mean, nothing.
No.
Literally nothing. Especially because those orphans are part of a cargo cult that worships a Boeing 747 that crashed.
It's strange, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. And this now Thunderdome, Beyond Thunderdome, is one of the more divisive movies. A lot of people who enjoyed the first two Mad Max films did not care for this one.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who like this one didn't care for the other two, but that's the way the universe laid out. And now in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, we're starting to see longer lasting effects of this social breakdown. But then we didn't see anything for 30 years.
It's a 30-year break in the franchise. So coming back. They come back really strong, I guess, with the story. And I'll tell you how strong, because this film is getting good reviews already. The Rotten Tomatoes site.
Yeah,
that's where a lot of us go to get, you know, our information, because so many reviewers compile their information there that it ends up being pretty accurate as far as the way most people feel. And they do professional reviewers and they do, you know, like critics and they do audience reviews. And for the audience reviews, 90% like this film, which is very, very high for that site. Usually it's much, much lower.
Yeah, they grade tough.
Yeah, definitely. And this is out of, oh, by the way, it's out of 270 reviews total. And the critics gave it a, you know, they have like a Rotten Tomatoes fresh rating on the site.
Yeah.
98%.
No way.
Yeah, it does very, very well. So it's getting great reviews. And like you said, you enjoyed the film a lot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would love to go see it again right now. If it were not our job to do this show right now, I would try my best to talk you into hopping in the car with me and going to watch this show.
I would love to do that. We should do that.
Let's
right
just
now,
do
but,
that.
But we have to do this show, so we're going to do that. And you know what? It's a fun one to talk about, though. And I desperately want to see this film because it looks like, you know, everything that you want to see in an action adventure movie, all packed into just 2 hours where it's just constant all the way from start to finish.
It's great.
All of the trailers are just nonstop adrenaline rush, you know, that kind of thing. So, and I sound like I'm selling it, don't I? I sound like I'm trying to sell the film. I'm not in any way, but man, these cars are so cool. All these vehicles. Mm-hmm. So here's the description of Mad Max Fury Road, again, from IMDb, just a quick synopsis. Mm-hmm. It says, in a stark desert landscape where humanity is broken, two rebels just might be able to restore order. Max, a man of action and few words, and Furiosa, a woman of action who is looking to make it back to her childhood homeland. Okay, so what's going on here is the apocalypse survivors, or some of them anyways, are enslaved in the Citadel. And Furiosa, who is a warrior that's played by Charlize Theron, I believe, she leads some of the tyrant ruler there. Has five wives, and she leads, or more than five, I think, but she takes five of them, hopefully taking them to escape, you know, to a secure place, along with Max. She's a friend of Max. They've formed kind of an alliance.
Yeah, they're not initially friends.
No, not initially. But for, you know, use in this mission, I guess, she uses this crazy big rig truck, like a big rig truck. I don't even think that's a great way to describe it. We'll get to that vehicle, but it's called the War Rig. And the War Rig, they try to outrun, the warlord and all of his henchmen across the desert.
The guy's named Immortan Joe. He's a cult leader. He has these people called the War Boys who all look like, you remember that movie Powder?
Yes.
They all look like the main guy in Powder.
Oh, no.
You know, very pale, hairless.
That's pretty creepy.
And they worship him. It's part of a cult. And then because Furiosa is taking these brides, I don't know if you can still call them brides if it's non-consensual, but because she's taking them across the desert to wherever this place is, then they start to follow her to try to grab her. At this point, I should go ahead and say, ladies and gentlemen, if you have not seen this movie yet and you do not like spoilers, anything after this point is going to count as a spoiler because we're going to be talking about the most amazing thing in this film. In this movie, the cars, right?
Yes, so many cars. I mean, I've read several articles here, you know, from the guy who created them about the cars themselves, you know, the previous vehicles that were used in, you know, the Mad Max series all the way from 1979 to 1985. But this guy that created this latest round of vehicles, his name is Colin Gibson. Mm-hmm. And Colin Gibson was the designer, the guy that said, and I don't know if he's working all alone. I'm sure that there are other people collaborating with him, but he's the guy, like the front man.
He's the head.
Yeah, he's the head guy. The one that was, you know, if the cars didn't show up, it was his responsibility. So we'll give him the credit, I guess, in this case. And he did an interview with Jalopnik that I read, and he's talked elsewhere. I've seen him in other interviews and other news sources.
In Bloomberg and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I know that Car and Driver mentions him a few times here, but we're going to go through, 10 cars that Car and Driver singled out. Also, we'll talk a little bit about this interview because it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's funny. I mean, he's pretty bold about what he says here to his crew. And it's kind of, I'm sure it's tongue in cheek because the way he said that I told, or the director, what George Miller, the director, told Colin Gibson, and he said, make it cool or I'll kill you. Now that's a strong statement from a director to a guy that's just creating the vehicles
but creating
the vehicles for a show like this.
Well, we don't know how intense George Miller may be. He was a doctor though before he became full time filmmaker.
Yeah, he's not gonna kill him. I mean, he's just saying like, you know what? I want this to be over the top. I want it to be. Look at the previous Mad Max movies and the vehicles they used, and that was always the standout. They were incredible vehicles and exactly what you would expect a kind of not forbidden society, but a leftover society.
Right.
That is just living on the scraps of what's left of humanity.
Yeah.
To put together in order to function in the desert.
And especially since we see how from the very first Mad Max, things have increasingly deteriorated.
Yeah. And, you know, another point is that because, you know, we're getting farther and farther away from where this apocalypse supposedly happened. Things are becoming more and more scarce.
Yes, exactly.
And so it's interesting to see that this is the most outrageous group of vehicles of the bunch. Now, that makes sense in that, you know, the chronology, of course, we're not going to go back and make them worse looking, I guess, than the 1979 cars or anything.
Right, right.
However, I find that the fleet of vehicles that I'm looking at here, incredibly impressive.
Yes, incredibly impressive. They look like something that would be, who's the Harley Earl? They look like if Harley Earl had a nightmare because he had been up too late eating weird food, designing cars.
Maybe like if he was collaborating with Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
That's maybe a way to describe it. Yeah. It's not quite Rat Rod. It's more than that. It's beyond that.
But it has Rat Rod influences for sure. So Gibson, Colin Gibson, overall, the number that I heard a lot, which might not be totally correct, is that he ended up with 88 final cars that were in production, but he actually made 150.
Yes. Yeah, made 150, knowing that for some cars you're going to have, because of what was required of them in the script, you're going to have to build three of them. You're going to have to build, you know, maybe two of this one.
Sure, one for the close-ups, one for the stunts, et cetera.
Maybe as a parts car, maybe one that's going to, they know is going to be completely destroyed. You know, there's no chance for this one. So at the end, I don't know if they destroyed all 150 or if they destroyed half of them. I've seen numbers that kind of are all over the place with this, but I know they destroyed a bunch of these cars. And, you know, you can see that in the film.
That's
one quick thing that we probably should point out is that the stunts were done without CGI.
Yes, the stunts are what are called practical effects. The vast majority of the stuff that happens here, counting the stuff with people, will be a practical effect. And that means that it is filmed artfully or whatever, but it's actually happening. Now, they did add stuff afterwards.
They did add the background. Now, I've seen some clips where it shows you the scene before and after. So they show you the stunt actually happening, and you can see, you know, the camera crew right in full view, you know, because it's shot from behind the scenes, I guess.
Right.
And the background is, it's desert background, but it's not quite what you see in the film. The cars, the action, the people flying, all that stuff, That is real life. That's really happening. But, you know, they may have laid out a cone or something like that to indicate where the charge was that was going to overturn the car. But in the film version, of course, they're going to paint that out. And they're also going to change the background to match where they would be in the film. Like if they were in, you know, a narrow cavern pass or something.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't know.
What am I thinking? A ravine of some kind, dried up lake bed or whatever it happens to be. You know, the background stuff was added, but the stunts, this is important because, man, there's some crazy stunts in this. Just from what I was looking at in the trailers, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to see the whole film yet, but the stuff that I've just seen in the trailers is just insane.
Well, it's fascinating too when you see those clips of the pre-CGI stunts because they're still very impressive. Now, Gibson did say that they used CGI or digital replicas of some of the vehicles for the wide shots or to serve as backups in case cars were damaged or destroyed. But he said it's more – he has this great quote, I think in Hollywood Reporter, where he said it's more exciting when you actually achieve the impossible rather than photoshopping it, with which – we completely agree. Scott, do you want to walk through these 10 cars?
Yeah, let's do that. And this is, again, this is just 10 of the multitude of cars that are out there. So these are the ones that Car and Driver picked. And it's fascinating to go through this. And I don't know if I have a number one favorite yet or not. Maybe as we talk this through, I'll choose one. I kind of got one that maybe I'm thinking is my favorite. But I would like to see the film before I make a decision. Do you have a favorite?
You're a wise man. I do, but I'm not going to mention it on air until we get to the end.
Okay. All right.
Cool?
One quick hint. Is it in this list or is it not in this list?
It's in this list.
It is in this list.
I'm sure it's in this list.
Okay. All right. Great. So let's start with one that they call Plymouth Rock.
Ah, yes. Plymouth Rock. Okay. So this from what originally people were guessing, but we've confirmed this is from the DNA of it is a 1937 Plymouth sedan.
Now, you know what? Guess it, looking at it, I would have guessed initially if I had seen it from a distance, Volkswagen Beetle. Just because, because the shape it takes, because this is the car that is covered with iron spikes.
Right. Yes.
Absolutely covered. I mean, there's not an inch that you could, you couldn't stand on this car without stepping on a spike. It's incredible. They look like they're 2 to 3 feet long.
Right. And these are, this is the car of a Raider that is, you know, that's meant to, you can tell if you look at, especially the front end and the wheels, that this is made to collide with their different things, maybe bust some tires or hit some gas tanks that are side mounted.
Sure. And nobody is going to be jumping on top of this car as happens often in this franchise, because that's the other thing is that a lot of times you'll see in these chase scenes that these guys are on poles. And you know what? Am I giving anything away right now? Am I saying this?
No, that's in the trailer.
All right. Well, I think there's a vehicle coming up that actually has some of these, there's some high strength or high tensile steel poles that some of these characters are using to bend back and forth and kind of launch themselves onto other vehicles. And this is one that you're not going to land on.
And they really did that.
No, it's crazy.
So the next one on this, which is great, but one of the less realistic ones to me, and I'll say why in a minute, is the Bigfoot.
Yeah, okay. Now this is this is one you probably have to have in the fleet. I mean, just because it's different, it makes it stand out, right?
Sure.
It's a monster truck that is put underneath a 1939 or 1940 Fargo pickup truck of all things. And Fargo, you know, I guess if you want to think about it this way, it was what a lot of Dodge trucks were called when they were sold in countries like Canada or Turkey and even, of course, Australia.
Ah, all right. Here's why I agree that it stands out in the fleet. But Scott, here's why I think this is one of the more unrealistic vehicles. All of these vehicles are works of art. And Miller made a very big deal when he was speaking with anybody in production or the actors or the drivers. Everything on these vehicles and in the costumes of the actors has to have a reason to be there. Mm-hmm. So apparently he would walk up to the actors and say, like, well, what's that? Why do you have that? What does that do?
Really, he's put them to the test, huh?
Something like that. And the same goes for the vehicle. So I get this, but here's what's unrealistic to me about it. Scott, this thing has 66-inch tall tires, right? Goodyear tires, 4 feet suspension.
4 feet of suspension travel. So this is going to be a truck that's jumping like a monster truck would be jumping.
Right, exactly. Except those tires, how could you keep those tires in that condition? They're a huge vulnerability.
Vulnerability for the vehicle, I understand that because of everything that's happened.
Sure.
But I've also seen arguments, and this is maybe getting just a little bit too realistic because otherwise this whole thing wouldn't happen. Some people say that, you know, if they are scavenging the wasteland for parts and pieces to put these things together, how is it that they have tires at all? Wouldn't they be riding on big solid chunks of rubber? Wouldn't they be using rims to get around on?
Wouldn't it be
the case that all rubber things, you know, even engine components
were
and everything
out.
Completely deteriorated as it really would be. But then again, you gotta suspend just that little bit of belief in order to allow these things to behave the way that they do. I mean, otherwise, you're not going to have a film like this if you don't have pneumatic tires.
Right. And maybe enough time hasn't passed to render all those tires.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it seems like my tires dry rot quickly in the garage. You know, I mean, and out in the Australian wasteland, you know, this apocalyptic wasteland, you would think they would deteriorate in, you know, a matter of weeks.
Yes.
You would think. But, you know, again, this is just one little bit that, you know, people pick at and say, and not necessarily that wouldn't necessarily happen that way. It just wouldn't. But again, look at all this stuff. This is so crazy. I mean, a lot of these cars are powered by supercharged V8s and, you know, they don't have any problem, you know, getting pieces and parts to keep those running.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, you know, like you and I, we have the internet.
Sure.
We can't keep our cars running sometimes because we can't find the right parts or, you know, I mean, okay, maybe that's a little bit of an overstatement, but I'm saying, it's difficult enough to find the pieces and parts to keep your own car on the road today.
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
But how are they doing it in this Australian wasteland? I know I'm overstating this and maybe I'm overcomplicating it.
No, I think that's a really good point because we've seen In the real world, we've seen instances where people are forced by something or another, maybe the age of the vehicle or something even bigger, like when Cuba was under such international sanctioning, they ended up having the mechanics in Cuba, I mean, ended up creating some of their own parts.
Great example. Look at communist Russia.
Yeah.
Some of the cars that they were building, some of their own, rings for pistons and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's some of the incredible lengths that they have to go to keep these things running. So maybe it's not that far-fetched that they're able to do this. Maybe there are some machinists left in the apocalypse, scarred world.
Right.
Is that the,
Well,
I don't know. I mean, apocalypse, that's pretty strong, but more than scarred.
Dystopian wasteland.
Yeah, that's a good way. Dystopian wasteland. Maybe there's enough machinists left that they're able to keep these things running. And I think that's what they're counting on is that belief.
Well, it has to be. There have to be, several very, very intelligent people because they're fabricating these machines. Like if we move on to the next one. Now, Australian listeners, if you don't know about this one, you're going to enjoy it. And U.S. listeners, if you haven't heard of this, don't beat yourself up because this is relatively obscure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is called Buggy Number 9. And Buggy Number 9 is basically a Corvette, but it's not really a Corvette. It's an Australian kit car that looks like a Corvette that was placed on top of a truck chassis, right?
Yes.
Yeah. A Holden 1-ton truck chassis. And so because the truck chassis was 22 inches longer, the real Corvette wouldn't work out. So they used this, I guess they use this kit car and lengthen that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got I think it's a Ford engine that's sticking out of the hood.
Yeah.
With the exhaust pipes coming straight out from underneath the hood. There's a gun on the top. There's, a crazy windshield that's a two-piece design.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a really strange looking vehicle. It looks like an off-road Corvette, really.
Right. And there's a great phrase here that the Car and Driver article uses, which is, Buggy Number 9 was created as sort of a last days of disco era vet running through misery while chewing on a fistful of meth. And that is apt. By the way, I should mention that this one, as well as Bigfoot, both have, mounted harpoon guns.
Oh, that's
harpoons.
A harpoon gun.
That's what, those are meant, usually when you see them in the film, the way that they attack is they shoot out and they have a chain attached or something like that.
Oh man, I've got to see this film.
You are going to love it.
I really do think I'm going to love this film. All right. So, the next one is called Mac. And, Mac is just loaded. I mean, why are you laughing? It's loaded with stuff. There must be something hilarious about
this
car.
Look at it.
Well,
I
guess so. Yeah. It's an old Mac truck, as you can imagine, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the basis of this. And of course.
It's a Mac tow truck. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And of course, it's a big R series, Mac R series truck. I guess it's in a lot of the action in this film. I mean, it's front and center because this one has an awful lot of gear. It has a lot of capacity to carry people, which is important in this.
Yeah.
It has all the battering rams that it would necessarily need.
And mounted harpoons.
I see the harpoons on the front there. I can clearly see those. It also is one of the vehicles that has these poles that I was talking about. Now, the poles are these high tensile strength steel poles. That people, and these are real stuntmen that actually did this in the film, they climbed to the top of those things. Like, someone climbing to the top of the crow's nest in a pirate ship or something.
Mm-hmm.
Only the poles are bendable. They allow them to slingshot back and forth.
By distributing their weight, they swing back and forth.
Terribly scary when you're going 70 miles an hour through the desert.
So they could swing down atop a car, for instance, another vehicle or a person.
Yeah. However, they would not be able to swing down atop, what was that first one? Plymouth Rock.
Yeah, which I love. You start to see the story or the ecosystem in which these vehicles exist when you see like the way that they've adapted to one another, almost the way the animals would in the wild.
Yeah.
I think that's a fascinating aspect. And we're going to go to one that I think is very interesting given our conversation about tires. But before we do, it's time for a word from our sponsor.
Yeah.
And we're back. So Scott, this one I'm excited about, and I feel for you not having seen the film yet, but man, we got to make a day of it. We got to go because we talked earlier about the problem of pneumatic tires in the desert in a post-industrial wasteland.
Mm-hmm. Right? And this solves that problem. This is a vehicle called the Peacemaker. And this is so bizarre.
This is so weird.
This is really a cool, and you know what? This is one of the cooler looking cars to me. And I've got another little side note on this vehicle, if you don't mind, that we can talk about. Something else that I saw online.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So this is a kind of a mixed match of Australian muscle and, I don't know, modern military equipment. I don't know how to put it better than that. But this is the 1971 to 1978 Chrysler Valiant Charger, which is sort of like the Ford XB Falcon over in Australia. And, of course, that's a prominent vehicle in Mad Max history, right? I mean, the XB Falcon, that was his original vehicle. But this is weird. This one is called the Peacemaker again, and it's sort of a, it's like a charger that's stretched over top of a U.S. military made, or well, actually a U.S. made ripsaw light tank chassis. So it's a tank.
It's a tank. They took the top off of a tank and put a car atop it.
Yeah. And not only that, it's a ripsaw light tank chassis. Now, do you know anything about the ripsaw light tank chassis?
Tell me a little bit.
Well, I watched an online video, a YouTube video, that was in another article. It was in the Jalopnik article. And this is where I think listeners should go and check this out, because it does have a clip of the ripsaw light tank chassis in action without the bodywork. Mm-hmm. And this is more than impressive, I'll tell you. This short clip, it's maybe 2 or 3 minutes long. And again, doesn't have the bodywork on it yet, but it's just the tank chassis before it was shipped out to where was it filmed? Africa, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, it was filmed in Australia and Namibia.
Okay, so both. I think this particular vehicle went to Africa, if I'm not mistaken. But what you'll see is a stunt driver, I guess, or just a driver, factory driver, with a helmet on in this chassis, this tank chassis, just blasting around this. This looks like a gravel yard,
super high speed.
Yeah, like maybe a gravel pit or something, where they have piles of gravel. Very high speed and an incredible sounding V8 engine that's mounted immediately behind the driver. So it sounds like the most amazing muscle car you've ever heard. Really, it's really cool. You know, that just fantastic American V8 sound. But then you see this tank, and this tank is just blisteringly quick. I mean, it's fast, and he's jumping. He's doing the full rotations, high speed runs down this trail that goes to maybe supposedly a quarry or something like that.
Right.
It's really incredible. So if you go to the Jalopnik site and you search, here's the title of the article. It's kind of long, but it's called "How the Man Behind the Machines of Mad Max Put a Hellscape on Wheels." That's the name of it. And I think if you just search Mad Max, you'll find that article.
Uh-huh.
And then look at that clip within there. I don't know what it's called, but it's well worth 3 minutes of your time to look at that.
And that's the same article where Colin says he learns the name of the outfit is Jalopnik and says, I would have named a car that. I talked to you guys earlier.
Yeah, how cool would that be to have a car named after the company that you
Well, had? There might be some sequels coming up, Scott.
And Peacemaker is operated, I guess, in the film by a character called the Bullet Farmer.
Yes, the Bullet Farmer. There are a couple of antagonists, right? And they all work together. Immortan Joe is the guy who owns the Citadel that has access to water, and people follow him with this cult, that he has a cult.
Sure.
The Bullet Farmer is a guy who has a bunch of ammunition. And I imagine that he makes this somehow.
Sure.
And he's got his crew, and then a guy called the People Eater.
The People Eater.
That's his name. Is by far the most disgusting character to me in the show, which is saying a lot if you've seen it, guys.
Yeah.
And he is in charge of gas. So they make gas and bullets, and then they have water.
Cool. Now, in Immortan Joe, there's a slight tie-in, I guess, with the original Mad Max film.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You said that is the same actor that played Toe Cutter in the first Mad Max film, is that right?
Yeah, Toe Cutter, one of the primary antagonists in that earlier film. The same actor came back to play Immortan Joe, the primary antagonist of this film. As far as I know, in the universe of Mad Max, they're not supposed to be the same person. They're not supposed to be related.
Of course not, because Toe Cutter met a violent end.
Yes.
Okay.
Spoiler alert.
All right.
but it's still kind of a shared universe. Neat tie-in. Our next thing up here is the FDK.
Mm-hmm. Now, what does FDK stand for, Ben?
It's open to interpretation.
It's likely something dirty that we can't say on car stuff.
On a family show.
But,
yeah.
You can leave that up to your own imagination.
Sure.
But this has, this is basically a Volkswagen Beetle. Mm-hmm. And kind of the shell of one, I guess, but it doesn't look a whole lot like it, in the end here.
No.
Well, maybe, but it's V8 powered, which of course is incredibly cool. Of course, the whole thing is just kind of tack welded together. It throws flames from the fuel that's incorporated in these barrels that are integrated in the structure. The whole thing kind of looks like a big, it almost looks like a big engine to me.
Yeah, the engine, they chopped the front half of the bug's body, and then they put in some molded, like two molded rods pretty much, mm-hmm. with a little skull emblem, Immortan Joe's emblem, and that's it. The rest of it is open, and this empty space is occupied by this gigantic engine.
Now, I think that it's a huge engine in the front, and, you know, of course, there's some extra stuff added on there, flames and things like that, and these pipes that you talk about, and of course, for structure. However, when I see those barrels that kind of jut out from the side of the vehicle, overall, this vehicle, when you look at it in certain directions, to me, the entire vehicle looks like one big engine. And I think I'm being fooled by that. It almost looks like a motorcycle engine or something where the cylinders.
That's a really good point. They look like cylinders.
Yeah, like the cylinders that protrude from the sides. It's almost like it's like a big V8 engine. But it's a Volkswagen Beetle that's buried underneath there. And again, a lot of these cars, they have crazy exhausts. And I think you have to climb in through the roof or through the windows to get into them. You can't use the doors as you normally would.
They're again, not exactly Bentleys.
And a twin wheel rear axle there. So it's a dually designed Volkswagen Beetle. With a V8. Maybe, it looks like even maybe a supercharger on top of that thing, now that I'm looking at it.
Yeah, you see it there.
And you see other vehicles that are superchargers.
Yes.
Which are incredible. I mean, neat design.
I love all of this stuff. It would be so much fun to just ride around in one of these, because these are one of a kind, somewhere between masterpieces and monsters, you know?
They're
maybe both.
True hot rods.
Yes.
I mean, they really are. They really work. If you see a vehicle that's powered by two V8s, it's got two V8s.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's amazing. So here's the war rig that we talked about.
The monster of monsters. Yeah. The Moby Dick of the wasteland.
Yeah. And you know, I'm going to kind of cross reference this with a couple of different articles here, because I saw it described in different ways. I think one has a little bit more information. Maybe the Jalopnik article has a bit more information on this one. Now, the war rig is a huge 6-wheel drive, Tatra semi-powered by two supercharged V8s.
Right.
That's it's amazing. That is not only a tanker, but it also has other vehicles welded to it. Isn't that right? There's a Suburban on the back, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. It has a Volkswagen Beetle welded to the hull. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where people hang out to kind of keep a lookout on the back end of the war rig.
Mm-hmm.
And you said what else was on it?
Well, I think I was wrong. I think I said Suburban, but it's a 1940s Chevy Fleetmaster that's welded to the back of the cab.
Oh, that's right.
So I don't know where I got Suburban from. Maybe that's somewhere else in this film, but, but this vehicle is huge. It has so many extra things added on. It's so big that when they weld the Beetle chassis onto the, or body rather, onto the back, that's just kind of looks like a cherry on top of the overall sundae here that is this war rig. It's enormous. It's huge, and it's covered with battering rams. It looks like the old cow pushers on the front of the old locomotives. Has that. I mean, it's just the meanest looking semi you've ever seen. It almost looks like it has snow tires, and of course those tires are guarded by spikes, of some kind. Something designed to just tear up whatever comes next.
It has an extra fuel pod attached to the back, kind of like a small trailer to haul. This beast itself, and I do use the word beast, is so unique as to almost be its own living thing. It has skulls, of course, real human skulls, mm-hmm. in the front for their raids or their runs to Gastown and stuff. It has a full complement of weaponry. This is clearly when I saw this, it reminded me a lot of the way that naval forces will have a carrier group,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you never see an aircraft carrier by itself. It's surrounded by smaller, more flexible or specialized vehicles.
More nimble vehicles. Nimble in that they can make faster turns. They can get back to, kind of cover their flanks faster than the aircraft carrier itself could. Same way the war rig can't make quick turns, can't really defend itself quite as well without this surrounding group of or armada of vehicles, I guess.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating. The scenes, there's a couple of scenes in the trailers that I've seen that mm-hmm. that are exactly that, Ben. It looks like they're the protective layer around this thing as it just continues to just steam across the desert.
Yeah, because despite the fact that it's powerful, it's more of a transportation vehicle than mm-hmm. it is an offensive one. But speaking of the kind of nimble vehicles that would orbit around this thing, let's move on to the Nux car. And this one has a little bit of controversy behind it, right? Because you'll hear people describe it as one of two things. You'll hear it described as a 32 Ford 5-window Deuce, or you'll hear it described as a 33 or 34 5-window Chevy Coupe.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to bust the myth here. As far as we can tell, it's a Chevy.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, Colin Gibson in the Jalopnik article says that, you know, in one of these quotes here, he says, out of his favorite vehicles, out of all of his favorite vehicles,
yeah,
he thinks this is his favorite. And he says that it's a, he says clearly here, he says it's a 5-window Deuce Coupe with hand-beaten metal and a supercharged V8 with nitrous. It's the most comfortable of all the cars.
It looks the most comfortable.
Well, I guess so. Like you said, it has glass, right?
Yeah.
It has glass, which is unusual for all these vehicles. Most of them don't. It's relatively clean looking. I mean, the exhaust pipes are mounted past the door, so you can't get in through the doors. You have to go through the roof on this
one. Right.
But it's got those poles all over it. I mean, it's loaded with those things. But those aren't necessarily the ones that they use to swing back and forth with, I think. That's just more decoration than anything, right? It also looks like spears.
Yeah, they look like spears.
And there's a cross mounted at the front of the vehicle, which is used to tie characters up to. I don't know if we should even say that or not, but maybe. We warned about spoilers, right? That there's there's a point where one of the characters in this film is tied to the front, almost like it's, you know, crucifixion almost, like on the on the front.
Right. And there's a reason for that, but we won't go into
it. So there's a little platform out in the front, almost like a little swim platform, like it would be off the back of a boat or something. But, again, an off-road, 5-window Deuce Coupe, which is a really clean design. Again, a supercharged nitrous-powered or nitrous-injected V8 engine. What a vehicle. I mean,
it can go in reverse at super fast speeds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that's like its superpowers, reverse high speed gear.
Uh-huh.
All right, cool. So that's an interesting car. And again, that's, you know, one of the guys that worked on this, Colin Gibson, uh-huh, the designer. That's one of his favorite vehicles, the whole bunch.
This next one is crazy. This is one of, although it's not the largest vehicle, it's one of the most outre to me, like the strangest.
Yeah, and it was described as a throne, I guess, of sorts, right?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's what we're talking about is the Giga Horse.
Yeah, the Giga Horse. Now, this is totally bizarre. And this is one of the vehicles that I remember, seems like a year ago, when we saw kind of a sneak peek of what was going on behind the scenes, you know, like the behind the scenes photos of the vehicles arriving on the set. This was one of them, and people were just blown away when they saw it. It is a, maybe where do we even begin with this? But
I guess the best way I could begin, if I'm being candid, I thought about this a lot, Scott. I feel like I must be on drugs when I'm looking at pictures of this thing.
You know, I felt the same way. It's almost like your eyes are deceiving you. And
like
it's
double
like,
vision.
It's like double vision. Yeah. It's two 1959 Cadillac Coupe de Ville bodies that are laid on top of one another. It's almost as if the back end of one is coming out of the back end of one is coming out of the back end of another one.
Right. Yeah. Like if you could picture the 59 Coupe de Ville, a little right in front of where the back tires would ordinarily be, cut that Coupe de Ville. Just cut that part off, take the tires off, and then take a second Coupe de Ville, break the rear windshield, and put that first one where the windshield was.
Okay, and then not only that, you put it on top of a chassis that looks like a monster truck chassis, but it's even different than that because it's almost like a combine would be used on a farm.
Yeah,
it's got a dually rear axle that uses enormous tires.
Huge.
Like that. They're tall and thin. There's two of them in the back,
yeah.
And then there's smaller ones in the front, so it gives it this extremely raked appearance. Like maybe a 30 degree rake, maybe something like that.
That's crazy.
It's almost 45 degrees. It's pretty intense. The front end of a caddy again. It's doubled up. But then it has, those big scoops in the front, almost like the cow pusher type thing again, but a little more aggressive than that. It's just more like fins almost. And then the engines. Okay. So the engines are this is crazy.
Yeah.
Two turbocharged V8 engines that are mounted alongside each other, and they go through one single drive shaft to the back end, to the rear end. Mm-hmm. So it truly is these side mounted, V8 engines. And I want to say, I can't quite see in this picture here, but I feel like they're supercharged.
Yeah, they have two functioning 871 superchargers. They're, as you said, both connected through that custom gearbox. And the main mechanic of the film was a guy named Mark McKinley, who was certainly earning his keep on that because he had to spend a lot of time, a lot of TLC with this baby. This thing is not only fully functional, but it generates 1,200 horsepower.
Okay, 1,200 horsepower, and that is because it has, you know, these two engines. These are both 600 cubic inch engines.
Right.
That are supercharged, that are on this thing. And they've got, I think it says, and this is how they put it, 120 meters of garden hose irrigation. That means 120 meters of fuel line, really.
Right, yes.
That's incredible. I mean, just to keep this thing going. Can you imagine having to keep this thing running in the, I don't know if it was in Australia or if it was in Africa, but
right.
Imagine keeping this thing running in the desert.
I am having a tough time with it. Well, the one other thing about this that is thematically interesting is that it was Colin Gibson who said that when he was envisioning this car, he was thinking about the character and how can we communicate the character. Just like in Fast and Furious 7. Furious 7, when the designer was thinking, how can we communicate the character through the vehicle, right?
Dennis, right?
Yeah. When Dennis was talking about that. So this guy, Colin Gibson, said that what is more like Immortan Joe, you know, I'll just read the quote. He says, in a world where nobody had one of anything, it seemed like a fait accompli that Immortan Joe would have a pair of 1959 Coupe de Villes. And I thought, yeah, because that does seem like such profoundly offensive decadence, right? And you haven't seen the movie, but just, I don't think it's a spoiler for you, Scott. Everything is terrible.
Yeah, sure it is. And yeah, everything is really, really terrible. And that's a great way to put it. I know I read that quote before because I think we hinted at that earlier on that.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the way to put it, that in this apocalyptic world, it would be difficult to find one of anything. But this guy's got two 59 caddies and he uses them in one vehicle.
And the water. He's a jerk.
And man. Again, this guy has got like, it's almost like this vehicle as Colin described it, it's like a throne.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is. I mean, it's like the rolling version of his throne. So, what a fantastic vehicle that is. Now, I guess no Mad Max movie would be complete without the Interceptor.
Ah, yes, our final vehicle of this episode, the Interceptor. So this is a 1974 Ford XB Falcon. Mm-hmm. We mentioned that earlier in the podcast, I think, and it has been as important to the films as Mad Max himself.
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
And, this thing is, I guess it's really, really beat up by this point. I mean, so it's looking pretty rough. I know it was looking rough early on, but now it's even more so because supposedly it's aged.
Right.
And it's aged poorly. As it would have, I guess, in that type of environment. But as he puts it, as Colin puts it, it was a legend spotted in the gutter. because, they found it rusted through and rattling with too many repairs and too few original parts. But, you know, the supercharger that they used in it, in the last of the V8 Interceptors.
Yeah.
It was important that, this one for the Mad Max movie had it. So it definitely does again. And an iconic car, I guess. It's an iconic movie car. Not necessarily one that a lot of people would find collectible, I think, because I've seen where the original the original Mad Max Interceptor was on sale for a while, I believe.
Yeah.
And I don't know where this was. I don't know if it's in Australia, like just in the classified somewhere. Once it was done with the promotional tours, apparently this thing sat for quite a while. Nobody really wanted it. Nobody picked it up. No one at auction said, yeah, I'll pay whatever it was or maybe someone just owned it and kept it in the garage for a while, but no one was actively seeking that vehicle as they do, like the original Batmobile or
right.
the original, well, if there is an original
generally
yeah.
One of the 18 original.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of them that are sold as original, but,
right.
Cars like that typically, once they're done with their movie production or
sure.
Production and promotion, they go up for sale, or as Dennis told us that, some of them are just destroyed because of liability reasons or
right.
held on to for parts or reshoots or whatever. But for whatever reason, this Interceptor, this Mad Max Falcon, 74 Ford XB Falcon, doesn't necessarily garner that kind of attention. I would think that it would.
It will now.
I think it will.
Because there are sequels planned and the Interceptor is so much a part of the story. There are some crazy fan theories too about this gap in time and the age of the Interceptor. And it's very interesting stuff. If you're a Mad Max fan and you have some time, like seriously have some time, at least a half an hour, start sifting through some of those fan theories. You're going to read some weird stuff. Scott, there's one vehicle that we must give an honorable mention to, although it was not on the list.
Okay.
Because otherwise people are going to kill us.
All right. We have to hear about them.
So you've seen the trailers.
I have.
Where that guy is standing on that one thing playing guitar.
Yes. I know what you're going to say because I read a small paragraph about it.
Yeah. The Doofwagon.
The Doofwagon.
This is the name of it. D-O-O-F.
This is an interesting one because this is like, and the way that I saw it described by the creator again, Colin.
Yeah.
He said that this is kind of like the representation of, you know, like the old drummer boy and the flute player.
Right.
You know, imagine like Civil War times, you know, that, you know, but that's not going to do out in the desert when they've got, you know, 1200 horsepower machines charging across the desert. So they need something like the Doofwagon.
Yeah. It's a morale machine, as they say. This was originally going to be based on an MAZ 543 Uragan or Hurricane, which is a Soviet Belarusian 8x8 artillery truck. Okay. So they had to, modify a lot of the design. It has a supercharged V8 engine with a mobile stage, wall of speakers, subwoofers, air conditioning ducts. It's like a rolling concert hall, and they have this guy who is attached to it by bungee cords, him and his guitar, and he just like bungees around playing music.
Him and his guitar. So they're charging across the desert at who knows what speed, supposedly 100 miles an hour, whatever it is. And this guy's playing the guitar atop a military vehicle that's just loaded with speakers. I mean, the speakers is a huge part of this whole vehicle. I mean, it's enormous. Think about a truck, a semi-truck trailer that is bent into almost an S configuration.
Yeah.
On both sides.
Yeah.
And at the end are these enormous speakers that blast out right next to him. And not only that, his guitar is a flamethrower.
Yes, his guitar does have the ability to emit flame. Oh, let me correct myself there. That initial design was the Soviet Belarusian thing. This is a MAN LKW Cat 1A1, still an 8x8 truck. It's got a 15-ton class vehicle modified with a wider track of 2,900 millimeters. And in real life, this thing serves as a carrier and launcher system for Roland and Patriot weapons.
It does look very military.
Even
in this form, it does. Now, with the addition of all those speakers, and by the way, all of those speakers are functional. So this thing really was operating, and it does operate. And he's really playing the guitar on top of this thing during the film. It's incredible how what level they went to make this realistic. I mean, they could have made those non-functional, and that would have been super easy for them.
Yeah.
But they went the extra length to make it functional, make mm-hmm. everything work. I love that.
Yes, and I hate to say that we have to draw it to a little bit of a close.
All right, so just quickly, without going over this whole thing again, do you have a favorite vehicle out of all the vehicles that you saw, or is it tough to choose?
I absolutely do have a favorite vehicle.
Okay.
If I had to choose one, I have one I would choose.
Okay, which one is that?
I would choose the Interceptor.
The Interceptor, okay.
Have to.
Because, really?
Yeah, because the Interceptor is the original one. It's a car for a loner, and no offense to my girlfriend if she's listening, but, you know, like in a post-apocalyptic world, I see myself as, you know, like a not like a cult leader or something, but a nomad, like a Mad Max. We didn't even talk about the motorcycles.
No, trust me, I totally understand the Last Man on Earth fantasy. I get it. I understand.
You,
I really do, and it offends my wife every time I mention it. And I don't mean it that way, but that's the way it comes off, I guess. All right, so my choice, without seeing the film yet, just by what I've read, what I've seen in photos and on, you know, these trailers.
And it might change when you see the film.
Yeah. Giga Horse.
Giga Horse, really?
Yeah. I like the dual Cadillac design. That is so cool.
It's so
and
trippy.
The idea with the you know, the twin supercharged V8s side by side, 1200 horsepower.
Yeah.
How can you go wrong with that?
You're going for flash,
well,
my friend.
I'm a 59 Caddy fan to begin with.
That's true.
So you stack one on top of the other one and come on.
It's double good, right?
Yeah, how could you go wrong with a vehicle like that? So, okay, Giga Horse is mine, but I'm going to watch the film soon and we'll see if that changes because who knows, maybe I'll see something there that is more appealing.
And we hope you enjoyed this episode. Write in and let us know if you have seen Mad Max Fury Road. Now, keep in mind, this is a very violent movie. It's not for everyone, but just from a car guy perspective, you're going to dig what they've done here. Or if you're a big fan of classic cars, you might be a little irritated by what they've done. But this is amazing. They put a lot of work into it. They spent years trying to find the right cars without computer chips or without they tried to find older cars that would work well and would survive this kind of stuff. We'd like to hear your thoughts. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're CarStuffHSW. You can drop by our website, CarStuffShow.com, to see every podcast we've ever made. And if you want to send us an email directly just to say hey or with a topic that you think would be cool to cover, we'd love to hear from you. Our address is
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.